Welcome to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel, and I'm joined by MNN's Brent Palm, Mike Grimm, and Blois Olson. We're going to delve into what's happening in the North Star State. If it matters in Minnesota, we've got it covered. This week, our continued series on long-term care center funding and shortages, preparing your family for severe weather season. The Gopher men's hockey team is headed to the Final Four, but first, highly pathogenic avian influenza resulted in the loss of millions of birds in Minnesota last year, from large poultry operations to backyard flocks. On this week's Minnesota Matters, MNN's Brent Palm talks with a veterinarian from the State Board of Animal Health about preparations being taken this year.
Well, Dr. Shauna Voss, senior veterinarian in charge of poultry with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think we all know that the highly pathogenic avian influenza had a major impact on Minnesota in 2022. I know we're the largest turkey-producing state, and it was affecting some wild flocks as well. I know you probably don't have a crystal ball, but is there any indication how bad the bird flu might be this year?
Well, we don't know for sure, and it's difficult to predict how a virus will behave. We do know that the virus never went away and continues to survive in our wild populations. And so we're fully expecting that during the spring migration period, which hopefully will be coming up soon if spring decides to join us this year, we'll be needing to keep our eyes open and be alert and be prepared for any virus that might be coming with that.
Okay. I know this wasn't the first outbreak, but I'm guessing we learned some things last year and maybe taking precautions this year?
Yeah, we had a total of 110 flocks that were infected with high path avian influenza, or HPAI, since March of 2022. About a quarter of those detections were in backyard flocks. And if you compare that to what we experienced in 2015, when we also had a total of 110 infected flocks, only one of those was a backyard flock. And so what that tells us is that our industry learned a great deal of information in how to protect their flocks, and we implemented some additional biosecurity measures that helped keep those flocks healthy and protected. And so we are working with our producers to make sure that those measures are continuing to be in place, and hopefully we will do an even better job this year.
Yeah, you made a good point, because when you think back to the 2015 outbreak, you think of the turkey flocks, the commercial operations. I want to say we lost, 9 million birds in 2015? But then last year, we talked to some of you folks and, they were saying, don't let the wild geese come near your chicken farm.
Yeah, we know that any bird that's got feathers on it is potentially susceptible to this virus. And so it doesn't seem, at least this virus we had in 2022, it didn't seem to discriminate against small hobby flocks versus larger commercial operations. Any bird with a feather that was out on the landscape was potentially susceptible. And so there's simple measures that even small backyard flocks can implement to try to protect their flocks and keep their distance from what the wild birds are carrying. And so we are, making sure that they've got their biosecurity measures in place and are preventing walking that virus into their birds.
Yeah, and I'm guessing maybe some of your larger commercial flocks, and those folks, they might know a little more about what precautions to take versus somebody who might just have a few in their backyard.
Yeah, but it's really important for even a small flock owner to learn about biosecurity and come up with a simple plan and stick with it, so that biosecurity is just that process of protecting your birds from disease. So being able to provide shelter and security so that they don't have any direct or indirect contact with wild birds like waterfowl is really important. Making sure that you're preventing and, eliminating that desire for those wild critters to come up near your facility, like making sure that you've got your feed contained and you're cleaning up any spills to reduce that attraction, are really important things.
Hey, I think I even did a story last year, you folks, someone at the Board of Animal Health, about a fox getting it last year.
Yeah, this virus is acting different than the virus that we experienced in 2015, and our colleagues and friends over at USDA Wildlife Services and the Department of Natural Resources are tracking all of those detections in both wild birds and in mammals. And so those are important things that we watch as that virus changes and as its ability to potentially infect different types of species. That's all really valuable information, and it's important that we've got our federal colleagues tracking those, how that virus is changing and the types of species that it's infecting.
I don't believe, when I talked with any of you folks last year, that there's any threat to humans. What are you folks saying in response to that?
So in general, this is not something that's a public health concern, okay? This virus has been shown elsewhere in the world to potentially impact people who have had very, very close contact with infected birds. And so we do collaborate and work with our colleagues on the Minnesota Department of Health side, and they're tracking and monitoring any responders and producers who are potentially in close contact with infected birds to make sure that they're not showing any signs of illness or picking up signs of disease. But it's not a food safety issue, and poultry continues to be a safe thing to eat.
That's what I was going to ask. I did an interview around Thanksgiving with somebody from the National Turkey Federation from Northfield, Minnesota. And he said, you know, it was a terrible avian flu outbreak, but it only affected less than 10% of the market. I think he was talking about turkey sales right around Thanksgiving. So the food's safe, right?
The food is safe to eat. As always, when you handle poultry products, including, you know, your chicken, your turkey, and your eggs, make sure you wash your hands and you cook your food well.
Okay, I did see a quote with you, too, that talked about early detection is one of the keys here.
Right. Finding the detection early is key to making sure that we don't spread the virus to other farms and other susceptible birds. And so our producers are always keeping a close eye out on the health of their flocks, and they are reporting any signs of illness, and we're getting those flocks tested as soon as possible if we have a flock that we're suspecting might be infected with influenza.
Well, thanks for the information, Dr. Voss. Yeah, like you said, got a tongue-in-cheek. Hopefully spring comes one of these days, but maybe we will check back with you when spring is in full swing to see how things are going, and, you know, hoping that hopefully the outbreak's not as bad this year as last year.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Brent. I know you will continue to follow this important story as we head further into spring and summer. More Minnesota Matters after this.
Unexpected reactions to smart financial decisions brought to you by feedthepig.org.
Well, I finally did it. I opened a 401k.
So you're giving up, just like that?
Giving up on what?
On getting an inheritance from a distant relative.
Don't you think if there were a billionaire in the family, we'd know about it by now?
Listen to me. We are one phone call away from riding horses on our own private polo ground. One call from christening yachts, having a butler, using summer as a verb.
How do you figure?
Look, everyone's got a rich uncle somewhere. It's statistics. So the best thing you can do is just prepare for the inevitable.
Right. Which is why I thought maybe it would be smart to take control of my finances. You know, start using a budget, get out of debt, set some retirement goals.
Budgets? Debt? You watch your mouth. Retirement shouldn't be a goal for us. It should be a way of life.
When it comes to financial stability, don't get left behind. Get tools and tips for saving at feedthepig.org. This message brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. MNN contributor Blois Olson continues his series this week on the critical funding and staffing shortages long-term care centers are facing around the state.
This is Blois Olson for Minnesota Matters. This week we are revisiting a conversation from Rochester, this time with Senator Liz Bolden, who highlights the urgency in long-term care funding and the idea that the system may be on the verge of collapse. This is after news just in the past week that another care center in northwestern Minnesota is closing, and there is threats of closure throughout the state. Here's our conversation that included Senator Liz Bolden.
Yeah, thank you so much for having these conversations and for including me. I'm really happy to be here with you all this afternoon. So just by way of introduction, so I'm Senator Liz Bolden. I represent District 25, which is most of Rochester down to about downtown and then up north through Orinoco and some areas north of Rochester. This is my first term in the Senate. I served one term, 2 years in the House just prior to this. My background is that I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse for over 20 years. My nursing has been in the hospital setting, although my very first job was as a CNA in a long-term care facility. So have a window into what that looks like from many years ago. And so, you know, caregiving is part of who I am and really important to me. And so I so appreciate the work you all are doing in the community and recognize how difficult it is in normal times and how extra difficult it has become and is now. And so as we talk about sort of priorities and how this falls and lands in the conversations that we are having, I will say, as I have conversations with folks across the district, you know, this comes up. I've had many conversations with folks, you know, working in and leading in long-term care facilities in our community. And, you know, without an exception, everybody, you know, just portrays that it's a system that's on the verge of collapse, essentially. It's really in crisis for a number of reasons, not the least of which is workforce, you know, as we are hearing. And again, you know, I'm a caregiver, it's my profession, it's what I do, and recognize that we don't, the challenges of bringing people in, both retention and recruitment is really challenging for a number of reasons. So we are absolutely having conversations about this in the legislature as well, and we'll continue to do so. I think there is recognition that where we're at is not sustainable, and there needs to be support and investments to be sure that you know, you all can keep doing the work that you're doing to ensure that people are cared for, which is sort of like a very basic thing, right? Like maybe the most basic thing that we need to do as a society, that be sure that people are cared for and have both recruit and retain the staff to do that. So we'll get into more of the details of what that looks like. But yes, I'm absolutely hearing that across the district, and we are absolutely having conversations about that in St. Paul. And it's not necessarily an easy fix of like, there's this one thing that we should do and it will fix everything. It's more complicated than that, right? And so I know Rep. Hicks and I both have some bills that are, you know, trying to get at different pieces of that, and happy to chat more about that. But yeah, it's conversations that we are having and will continue to have and recognize the complicated issues that are before us. So,
Senator Bolden, coming from the House, but also with obviously a very thin majority in the Senate, one of the things that we've always discussed when it comes to long-term care is that this is less partisan an issue than other issues. Is that an opportunity this year to maybe bring people together and look at this crisis, as you said, that this feeling of collapse, how do we prevent the collapse?
Yeah, I think absolutely that's right. I think this often isn't, as it shouldn't be, a partisan issue, right? Like making sure that people are taken care of isn't a red or a blue issue. It's a human issue. And, you know, the reality is when we talk about, you know, caregiving, at some point or another, all of us will need that. And we all probably have experience in our families of somebody we love needing care at some point too. So I think while it's, you know, something that is, you know, very real and tangible for people, you know, I was thinking about as you were talking, I'm asking Rep. Hicks about, you know, sort of how we view this and how our colleagues view this, especially maybe first termers. I think, you know, part of what I think about that is that, you know, this is a team sport, right? And we can't all be experts on every topic. And so that's why, you know, our lived experience and background is great, because we all bring what we know, right? And so Rep. Hicks brings her expertise and knowledge about, you know, DHS and disabilities and those pieces. And I bring with me my experience with caregiving. And I think it's, you know, it's sort of our job to help educate others and sort of raise awareness with others in our caucus for whom this isn't their like main issue, because they're working on other important issues. I also think, you know, while caregiving is close to many of us, what that actually looks like, I think is pretty far removed for many people. So, you know, what it means to be a nurse in a long-term care facility and be responsible for a whole wing of patients on an overnight shift with maybe one aide to help you you know, and the responsibility of that, and just the stress and pressure of that, and the desire that you want to do your best and take care of folks, but, you know, who knows how long it's going to be before you may be able to answer a call light because you are trying to pass meds for, you know, to 8 more people, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I think like the specifics of what that really looks like and feels like and how difficult that really is, I think is not well understood by people.
Thanks, Blois. More Minnesota Matters coming up. Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. This year's severe weather is off to a hyperactive start, and meteorologists are predicting increased tornado and flood risks for much of the country this spring. Joining me today is Jennifer Pippa, Vice President of Disaster Programs for the American Red Cross.
I know you folks there at the American Red Cross are really getting ready and putting out a lot of information and awareness to the public. Can you share with us your key message as we head further into spring and summer?
Absolutely, Tasha. The first message is that 2023 has really started off with a bang, for sure. Those atmospheric rivers we're seeing in the Pacific are just creating havoc with poor folks and families in California. And unfortunately, what we have seen this winter with that heavy snowpack, meteorologists are now predicting that we could have a fairly significant flooding season this year, because as all that snow melts, that water needs a place to go. That, in combination with warmer weather, they are forecasting a higher than average severe weather and tornado season in the March, April, and May time. So really what we want folks to know is that severe seasons are here. We're seeing a lot of severe weather, and the time to get prepared is right now before you become impacted by a potential disaster.
Talk a little bit about some of the key ways folks can get prepared for the severe weather season. Can you offer us some tips?
Sure. There's really 3 simple things that families can do today so that they're ready in case they get impacted by a disaster. They can get a kit, make a plan, and be informed. And the first is really to create an evacuation plan. Understand from your family's perspective how people need to leave the house and their communities and neighborhoods, and communicate that among your family members. You may not all be in the same place when an evacuation is ordered, so you want to make sure that you've got a agreed upon rally point so that you can make sure everyone in your family is safe and accounted for. The second is build an emergency kit. Really simple, basic things like bottled water, non-perishable food, a flashlight, some battery-powered radios. But don't forget some things like really important documentation, insurance papers, birth certificates, identification, and medications. A lot of times in the heat of evacuation, folks will forget to pack their life-saving medications, and we want to make sure that folks remember to do that. And then the third is just stay informed. Understand and listen to your local emergency officials. When they order an evacuation, please go ahead and evacuate. Find a safe place to stay, either with friends, family, a hotel, or if you're unable to pay for it yourself, you know, look on redcross.org and see if we've got shelters open for you to take refuge in. And then don't return back until emergency officials have told you it is safe to do so. Those are really easy steps that families can take today to make sure that they're prepared.
And, you know, on the flip side, worst case scenario, when a disaster happens, I know that there's always a need for Red Cross financial donations among giving blood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So when we are faced with responding to a disaster relief operation, help really can't wait, and financial donations are the quickest and the best way to help us provide a safe place for families to stay, food, medication replacement, and help families begin their long and tough journey back through the recovery process. And so what we're asking the American public today is to support us financially with a donation at redcross.org/givingday. They can also roll up their sleeves and donate blood. We provide just under 40% of the nation's blood supply. And so for an hour of your time, you can actually save up to 3 lives with 1 donation of blood. And then the last thing you can do is you can raise your hand and volunteer your time. You can become a Red Cross volunteer. You can learn how to help families prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters. And you can do that by just going on our website, typing in your local zip code, and finding the local chapter and understanding all the different ways you can help your community.
Thanks again to my guest, Jennifer Pippa, Vice President of Disaster Programs for the American Red Cross. Time for our last break. More Minnesota Matters right after this.
Did you know that more lives are lost to lung cancer each year than breast, colorectal, and prostate cancers combined? Lung cancer will claim more than 135,000 lives this year. But new treatments have improved survival for many with the disease and offer new hope for many more. So does lung cancer screening with low-dose chest CT. The American Cancer Society and most major professional organizations recommend that adults ages 55 and older with a long history of smoking, even if they have quit, should talk with their doctor to learn more about lung cancer screening. Lung cancer screening saves lives by detecting lung cancer early when it's more successfully treated. So, ask your doctor if lung cancer screening is right for you. And if you smoke, ask your doctor to help you quit. Visit the National Lung Cancer Roundtable website at nlcrt.org. That's nlcrt.org.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. The top-ranked Golden Gopher men's hockey team plays in next week's Frozen Four in Tampa, Florida. Minnesota will face Boston University in the national semifinals on Thursday. The Gophers advanced to the Frozen Four after winning last weekend's NCAA regional tourney in Fargo. The most outstanding player in the region was Bryce Brodzinski of Blaine, who joined MNN sports director Mike Grimm.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously special being in Fargo because it was kind of close, and all the fans that showed up and all the family that was there. It was obviously a pretty special moment being able to win the championship there.
And then you, of course, had a hat trick in the Thursday opening round game against Canisius, and it was a natural as well, three straight, and really put the finishing touches on that 9-2 win. What was working that you were able to find the net three in a row?
Yeah, I mean, I had the one that got called back, and then after that, I just started shooting the puck every single time I got it. And so, obviously my line mates weren't too mad at me shooting the puck because, they like getting assists sometimes whenever it goes in. So, I just started shooting the puck, and then, luckily they all went in.
You said after the game that you thought that one might get overturned, the double post, I guess, what it hit the right and then across to the left. Could you see that maybe it was dicey?
Yeah, well, you can kind of tell the difference between the crossbar and the back crossbar. And it sounded like crossbar pipe. So, I kind of knew it went in, or I knew it didn't go in. So, when guys kind of held it around, I was asking them if it was going in. They're like, just go through the line anyways, just in case it did go in. So, I kind of figured it didn't go in, but, obviously wasn't too frustrated about it.
Yeah, so you were literally inches away from four goals in that game. Take me through that game, too, because, it's the age-old 1-16 and all this stuff. And, obviously once you guys got your legs under you, that major was big. You got a couple of goals, and then it was, you guys were dominating the rest of that game. But what was that like emotionally to get going and get started and get your skates under you? And, how do you try to keep out of your mind this idea that, oh, it's a 1-16 and you can't lose and all this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty nerve-wracking because, I mean, you're supposed to win. And so, they were up 2-1 on us at one point, and it's kind of a scary thing because you never know what can happen. And so, like you said, luckily we got that 5-minute major and we got a couple of goals. But, right after Kurth kind of scored that goal to give us a lead, I knew there wasn't really any turning back. And, we're a good enough team to where we can kind of outscore teams in some scenarios when we're not playing our best. And, luckily we scored a few goals to get us in the lead. And then, it was a pretty scary moment. I mean, it's not a position that we wanted to put ourselves in for sure, but, we were happy that we got the win.
Yeah. Once it got going, it got going. I thought too, and again, hockey's this way, which is why that happens sometimes where a four can beat a one or a 16 can beat a one. And that just, it was weird early, some spinning pucks and different things. You guys had some chances and the puck just, the puck luck, as they say, and it's a real thing in hockey. Did you guys feel, now looking back, did you guys feel, as it was 2-1 there, did you feel like things were tightening up, or did you feel still pretty comfortable? Like, hey, this is, because pretty soon as the clock starts melting away, I suppose you're thinking, all right, we gotta kick this thing in gear here.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of knew that we would have our chances. I mean, they turned the puck over a lot in the first couple of periods when they had the lead, and we just weren't capitalizing on it. And we knew that if we just kind of stuck with it, that those opportunities would end up being goals. And we didn't really change much. We just eventually started scoring on the opportunities that we got. And but their goalie played unbelievable through the first two periods, and you know, kind of got unlucky in the third with a couple of bad bounces. And yeah, but it was just kind of sticking on top of our game, and then you know, the opportunities that came to us, we were able to put away.
How much did that third period affect you guys in terms of how you started that on Saturday against St. Cloud? It looked like the momentum carried right over to me.
Yeah, I mean, we were definitely confident going into that game. And, you know, we kind of saw that any team can play with us if we kind of give it to them. And so we really are – Coach Bonsko was kind of all over us about having a good start and our first couple of shifts, and we thought we played really good in our first couple of shifts and kind of stayed on top of them and didn't really have any opportunities until about the 10-minute mark of the first period. So we were definitely happy with how we started.
I know I've been around baseball a lot too, and home run hitters can remember almost every home run they hit, even years before. As a goal scorer, I mean, you are a goal scorer. Do you remember – can you remember goals? Like, could you walk me through all three of the goals from Thursday and know exactly how they unfolded?
Maybe. I think it was, I mean, my first two were kind of just turnovers and, you know, an odd man rush. And my third one was kind of, Hughie just dumped it deep and it bounced off three people and goalie put it right on my stick and I shot it before he had a chance of getting back to it. So, yeah, you remember everything. You don't remember all the details, but, yeah, you remember how they go in and, you know, what kind of led up to them.
So in Motzko, your head coach has talked about that when you start feeling it, the puck just starts going in the net. Can you explain kind of how that works with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's just a confidence thing. It's like if I know I can go out there and score a goal, it gives me that confidence to kind of hold the puck a little bit longer, make a play, you know, get open in certain scenarios where I wouldn't want to go because I was kind of afraid to get into that spot, and then a turnover happens where you know, if I'm playing with confidence, I'm kind of free. I'm playing with the puck well, and I'm shooting the puck a lot. And so, yeah, I think it's just when I get on, I'm happy with how I'm playing. I'm not afraid to shoot the puck, and I'm not afraid to take chances. And I think that's kind of the main thing.
You mentioned after that Thursday game, and then again, I think even with me when we did a little post-game locker room session, that Jackson Nelson had told you, hey, shoot some more. One, he wants the assist, as you mentioned, but two, and you took it to heart a little bit in this regional, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I had 15 or 16 shots in those two games combined. So, yeah, I mean, it's – you're not going to score goals if you don't put the puck on the net. So, yeah, this weekend I definitely wasn't afraid to shoot the puck, and I think both my line mates were pretty happy with me.
That's Gopher forward Bryce Brodzinski with MNN Sports Director Mike Graham. To hear this entire 40-minute interview, you can listen to the Go Gopher podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Minnesota Matters. Be sure to join us again next week on this MNN affiliate station. Same time, same place. Until next time, I'm Tasha Radel.